I'm delighted to be here today with Jordan Hall and DC Schindler. And I'm guessing that both of these gentlemen don't really need an introduction, but just in case, DC Schindler is a professor of metaphysics and anthropology at the John Paul II Institute in Washington, DC. And Jordan Hall has spent many years building disruptive technologies and CEO and co-founder of Qualia Sciences. So the topic that we are going to discuss today is one that they have both agreed on, which is creating a bridge from philosophy to theology at the horizon of science. And that's the wheelhouse of this channel. So I'm really excited to hear what you both have to say. And maybe we could start with Jordan and see what how you want to lay that topic out and then get the discussion going.
Okay, so I think what I'd like to do is maybe make a, I'll put up forward a premise. I'm not sure that it's true, but it's worth sort of orbiting around. And it has two moments to it. The first moment is that at a historical level, we are in a what I think people for the past 5 or 6 years have been calling a liminal moment or a time between worlds, which is to say that maybe akin to the period of the 15 and 1600s, perhaps even more fundamental than that, perhaps the good old-fashioned Axial Age, we have a point at which the set of ways of thinking, and to a meaningful extent also ways of living, that have become largely unconscious because we've been operating with them for, let's say, 500 years, are in the process of being made conscious because they're no longer actually fit for purpose. And this puts us in a transitionary period, which has a lot of implications. Moment two is to say that both the domain of science and the domain of philosophy are ultimately grounded in the domain that we would typically categorize as religion or the way that we talk about religion, i.e., theology. The distinction I make there is between the embodied practices of life and the stories that we would tell about, or the theories that we might make adjacent to it, and that's reorienting ourselves properly in that foundation is necessary when you're entering into this kind of a liminal moment, because first you have to ground, and then from the ground you can now reorient yourself with the reality that you're actually living in, and then you can begin the process of developing something that is in the category of philosophy and science in that context. So that's the premise that I would put forward.
That's I'm a little surprised because I was going to say some of those things too, not as well as you did. You say them much more succinctly than I would be able to, I think. But I also wanted to situate this in the historical context because I think that's proper, and it's really interesting that context is part of what you were saying. In a way, we've tend to take our historical circumstances for granted as just a kind of hidden background and focus on the problems that are facing us. But I think the nature of the challenges to our ways of thinking and being have become so radical that it's becoming more natural to us to step much further back than we're used to, and thinking about where we're going in a more universal global sense, and where we're coming from, and what and to go to the roots of things. So I mean, in that sense, I think we live in a really exciting time. I mean, it's paradoxical. It's exciting because in some sense it's terrifying and dangerous. We're messing with things that could fundamentally alter life as we know it, in all sorts of ways. But it's exciting because I am strongly convinced that human beings are what Aristotle called the rational animal, which means that we are the kind of animal that can't even live properly as an animal without thinking. And to think means to strive to get to the core of things, to the heart of the matter. And so it's precisely the radical character of the problems that are facing us that are actually in allowing us, for the first time, I think in a long time, to start to get to the heart of things. And so there's something, we have an opportunity at this moment to recover our humanity in a way that I think is, is a gift.
Oh wow. Holy smokes. Hold on, just
Sorry.
real quick. I just saw the
Sure,
tapping
please.
behind you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Are you? Yeah. It's a fascinating. That was a Christmas present for my wife a couple years back. But
Tell me a little bit about the story of it, because I recognize it, but I'd like to know
you
more.
know, it's interesting. It's a set of tapestries. It's sort of the culminating set. Let me move out of the way for a sec. It's a the tapestries. There's controversy over what they mean, but they seem to display the human senses. The set of tapestries display the human senses, and this one seems to capture at the end. So that it's a mixture of animals and human beings. But this one here, it says in French, "À mon seul désir," with respect to my single desire. And that seems to be the human desire that's connected to beauty as the kind of crowning of perception of the world and where the animal kingdom sort of transitions to the specifically spiritual human realm. So it's a fascinating. There's some other things in there. I'm especially fascinated by the lion and the unicorn, which is a pair that has some interpretations, political interpretations of in England, but it seems to me there's something about the nature grace that the lion is the kind of culmination of the natural world and the unicorn as grace, as something supernatural that I really like here. Man is not only at the intersection. This sounds like a digression, but I think it's actually going to be related to some of the things we talk about here. But man,
Agreed.
at the intersection of the animal and spiritual world, but then also, the intersection of nature and grace. I think that's a proper way to think of human existence.
Yeah, okay, let's I'm gonna I agree with you. I think there's stuff going on that's kind of like building and being able to, how does this work? So there's a word that I've been working on. I think it's called performative confirmation, which is inverse of performative contradiction, which is that we're engaging in a process whereby we are actually embodying the thing that we are endeavoring to communicate or think or speak about, which is deeper than our ability to communicate or think or speak about it. So in this case, we are currently operating be at the horizon of science, and we are noticing that there are a variety of things that are going on that are in our peripheral vision, and we're endeavoring to cultivate the faculty, which I call faith or pisthis, of being able to orient ourselves on the basis of these things that are on the peripheral vision. So let me ask you, is there a tapestry in this cycle that has the unicorn beneath a pomegranate tree with drops of pomegranate juice falling on the unicorn?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I'd have to. It's been a while since I've studied them, so offhand, I
So
don't. Why do you ask? That's a
yes.
very precise question.
Oh, it's very precise. I want to throw this out there. So first, how do I say? I think there is, and if there's not, interesting. But here's the what popped into my mind when I saw, frankly, the unicorn behind your head, which is some period of time ago, let's say on the order of 4 or 5 months, my daughter was reading a story with my youngest, I'm sorry, my wife is reading a story with my youngest daughter, who's 5 and a half. It's a Magic Schoolhouse book. And in that book, there's maybe six images. It's mostly text with a small number of images. And in one of the images, there was a picture of a tapestry with a unicorn sitting beneath a tree that had drops on it. But as a parent, you're reading the story, you're not really examining the picture, but my wife happened to notice it and attended to it. And then the next day, or perhaps the day after, so from a narrative perspective, we'll just make it the next day because I think it has a better timbre to it. They decided very willy-nilly, after going grocery shopping, to go walk through an antique store, which is a big cavernous warehouse antique store. Ostensibly, the way my wife's mind began to tell her why she was doing it was to maybe look for a birthday present for a friend. But instead of walking in the area where small things would be, that where one might find a birthday present, she found herself walking all the way to the very back of this warehouse. Which again, I should point out is a very unreasonable thing for her to do in the context of being with my 5.5-year-old. It's not the sort of thing that would normally happen. They get to the back of the warehouse and she turns left, and lo and behold, there's in fact that actual tapestry in its full tapestry form, which is a shocking thing because there's no reason to believe that that tapestry or a replica thereof would ever be in this particular location. And when she saw it, it had the appearance, she had the experience of, wait a minute, didn't I see that? So she took a photograph of it, raced home, looked in the book and saw it there, and then began researching the underlying narrative of what that tapestry is, what the cycle is, and what the implications are. And so let's see, what I would bookmark, it's funny, Karen, because we'll be speaking with Michael Levin sometime soon, is the inquiry of something like higher order intelligence, or what our experience, what our first person experience would be like if we were participating in something that was larger than ourselves and had an intelligence greater than ourselves that was able to coordinate with us in some fashion. So that's the phenomenological inquiry. And the hypothesis being that there's something going on in that fashion that is made available in this current historical moment. It may in fact be like a necessary faculty. To even use like a very simple language, the literacy of the future is facility with the Holy Spirit.
So, I'd be interested to know, do you tie that in at all to the content of the image in the tapestry? Is there, have you thought about the meaning of that particular?
As it turns out, yes. When we took a look at it, and unfortunately, right now I can't remember. I remember it actually felt intensely present to where we were at that moment of our lives as a symbol, a little bit searingly, like too close to home. And of course, the absurdity of it appearing in these locations brought it high into your attention, but the meaning or the content of it had a payload that was meaningful for us as a family.
No, it's interesting that as you were talking there, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Magnolia, P.T. Anderson.
With Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is in it. He's got a strange role in that movie. It's a strange movie in all sorts of ways. But I think that the question that you're raising is precisely the point of that movie. He goes through a series of strange coincidences you mentioned similar and raises this question, is there a meaning to this otherwise sort of seeming chaos? Is there a perspective that we can take on the whole that would allow us a deeper insight into what's going on in the present? So it's very similar. If you haven't seen it recently or haven't seen it, I'd recommend it.
Yeah, I think it's
I
been talked
wouldn't
about.
watch it with your daughter. I don't know how old she is. But in any event, it's really worth contemplating. It's from a technical perspective, I'd like to think through in some detail this faculty of pistis that you're raising and how exactly you would relate that to reason. What's the relationship between faith and reason precisely that I think might be worth teasing out a bit further.
Okay, nice. So first, I definitely make a distinction between mere symbolic processing. And here I'm using symbolic, not in its proper sense, but in the sense of signifiers. So mere signification processing or computation, if you'd like. It's actually easier now that we have computers. And the process of using intelligence to navigate a loop of relationship with the exterior in an ongoing developmental arc. Right? So I would consider the latter to be reason and the former to be a particular faculty that sometimes is useful in the context of reason. So the notion, for example, of having a subjectivity at all, that subjectivity has a capacity to do something with experience, which enables a transformation in how that subjectivity then expresses itself out into the world. It has a developmental capacity in the sense that the subjectivity can, in fact, change and become more and more capable. And that there's something about that that has a, how do you say,
Feedback,
pardon?
a feedback of sorts, right?
There's a feedback characteristic which is intrinsic to being a rational animal. That notion of the evolutionary, oh, that's exactly the point. The evolutionary dynamic that has inured in the physical, in the genetic phenotypic dynamic up until relatively recently, by hypothesis us, I can wave my hands around that a little bit, shifted into a new domain, which is this subjective objective loop of learning that happens in the context of having something going on, say mind or subjectivity, that has again a capacity to change its nature in relationship with the environment that it's interacting with and change the environment it's interacting with, right? So you can sort of do a transcendent move where you abstract the architectures of evolution from the specifics of genetics and phenotypes, find a more mechanism independent object, and then notice that same object occupies or occurs in this location. So that's, to me, that's reason. And by the way, this is where I also find the binding between of the way that Verveke talks about relevance realization is the same kind of thing. It's the through line between those two.
Okay. And then where would you put faith? So pistis, this other.
Ooh, nice. To get there, I have to actually make a bit of a branch and then come back.
Okay.
And it's connected to the point you were making in terms of meaning and participating in meaningfulness. And we can use the film as an example. And it has to do with the distinction between what my friend Forrest Landry calls symmetry and continuity. Or if we want to make it a little bit more legible, we could say the analytic and the synthetic, or the apart and the whole. That meaning requires continuity. Now, if you imagine a film, what we notice is that we don't actually experience the frames as frames. We experience a whole moment that is present as a phenomenological event. And then we don't actually experience the series of phenomenological events as distinct, completely separate, analytically separate pearls on a string. We actually experience the building of a kairos, the building of a wholeness of moment. And that's where the meaning occurs. It occurs in the wholeness of the experience. The constitution of the being, or now, in fact, the symbolon of the event. Okay, so then and this I think is also true, say, of life. Like one of the challenges, one of the perhaps the root of the meaning crisis is that we have highly grounded ourselves in the analytic or in the symmetry process and have become almost incapable of interacting with the continuity process or with the whole qua whole. And this loops us then back to the notion of pistis. The pistis is a faculty that is both by the nature of being in relationship with the whole, obviously it is part of the whole. So pistis is both a faculty of our participation or membership in continuity with the whole, and is by which we are able to facilitate our relationship with that whole. So this may actually end up collapsing. These might in fact be isomorphic, these two notions.
Well, it might it'd be interesting if I may jump in here. I find helpful and be and it would be interesting to see how this would map onto what you're saying. A technical concept in Catholic theology, medieval theology of a theological virtue that would be distinct from a natural virtue. So, from this perspective, in this tradition, faith is what's unique about it is it's not in the first place a human faculty. It's thought of as a gift from God. So, and you mentioned the Holy Spirit. That, I mean, it's very interesting. So this is the most basic subject of faith and object of faith is God, so that it's a perspective that actually enters into the imminent horizon from a transcendent perspective. So there's a real radical difference between the kind of human capacities to know. Now, you need to interpret that in a way that's not dualistic. It doesn't, it's not just sort of magic from above, from the outside. As a gift, it actually does enter into the human spirit and the human mind and human reason. And in fact, all the way into human perception. It's something that transforms even our imagination and sense perception.
Mm-hmm.
Of the world, but it sort of connects this with a perspective that lies beyond the world, and that's one of the reasons why it's such a you can't make yourself believe in this particular sense, and belief is not just when people think about faith and distinguish between faith and reason, they will often think of reason as something you can sort of see that's true, and faith has a kind of an uncertainty about it. You sort of guess and you just entrust or something like that. That's not quite adequate. It's actually more certain, but the point of the certainty, it doesn't come from within you in a way. It's a certainty into which you're carried. There's something really beautiful about that. If I may go back to the P.T. Anderson film, one of the things that's so fascinating about this film, the very last scene, and I read an interview with him later, and he said that he got the whole concept of the film started with this final scene, and that is this woman who has had a mess of a life, and she's finally being consoled and redeemed by a policeman, a kind policeman. He sort of represents an authority figure, but while he's talking to her and telling her, she's got to make better choices, but in a way that's filled with just paternal affection, she turns and looks off she looks at the audience. So it's really an extraordinary moment. She looks at the audience and she gives this smile of redemption. Now, what's so extraordinary about that is that you see she's left the frame of the movie in a way. It's a moment of like this radical transcendence that's being depicted artistically in the film, but I think it's an acknowledgement of a perspective that goes beyond, you might say, the imminent frame. And there's something about that I think captures something essential to what faith is.
This is really nice. I like this. Yeah. So a piece of the language that I would maybe use there was just. So this makes sense to me. This meshes with the way that I'm understanding it.
Okay, yeah.
That maybe a distinction between faith and reason is that faith has this grounding in continuity. Like you said, it's a gift from God. But that gift is not a sense of dualism or separateness. It's not crossing, because it has to do with our participation in or our relationship, right? That notion of relationship and the way that communion has a characteristic of union, right? Communion. Whereas reason sort of is resting largely on us. So they both have a characteristic of endeavoring to have a maximum use of our capacity to be in a developmental relationship with the world. Faith has the deeper foundation of actually being the actual world in relationship with us, or reality, or God in relationship with us.
Yeah. And that allows you in a way to kind of crystallize a whole in a more robust sense than simply a perceptual gestalt or something.
Absolutely. So just to kind of like hammer it out from looking off screen to the audience.
and actually before just, and the temporal dimension, I'd like to get into that, because you mentioned future. I mean, that's really interesting, but I just want to note that so we don't lose it. Sorry, go ahead.
So the thing I wanted to kind of highlight is just recognize that in the waning moments of our current era, word faith, particularly in English, I have no idea what it is in the other translations, but from pistis to faith, has been burdened with a meaning of effectively sort of maximally delusional ideology. And the one key point is to say not only not, but in fact, almost exactly the inverse of that, as you said. And that anybody who begins to understand or come into relationship with this idea of what pists is, you can then begin to drill down on how their belief structures work. Like the simplest thing would be like, okay, does 2 + 2 = 4? Okay, how do you know that? And as it turns out, the answer is actually faith is how you know that. And there's a certainty that you can feel the quality of that certainty that you can't actually point to analytically, but nonetheless is present and very grounded, right? You can make choices on the basis of that. And we can even put that there as well, by the way, because there's a beautiful connection between the is-ought problem there, because faith is also the kind of thing upon which you can, in fact, ground choices.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's connect then this point to the your opening statement that I reinforced about our historical moment. In what sense, maybe this would be an interesting thing to think about together. In what sense are we is the world ripe for the discovery of this dimension that we're talking about? And in what sense also are the kinds of developments that we're seeing in science and technology maybe priming for this, or at least opening up the possibility, and certainly not by any necessary procedure or movement. What would
Well, I'll just start throwing them up. I mean, there's a bunch in there. They're quite different, or at least at first order, they seem to be quite different. So, in no particular order, the first, of course, is the actual consequences of lived multiculturalism. Like the reality is that the global village is now fully or largely significantly realized, and we're noticing that we actually do all have distinct worldviews. And we have distinct ideologies that sit inside those worldviews, and they bang against each other. And that the processes that had been developed during the period of the Enlightenment for enabling ideological structures to enter into relationship are strictly inadequate to the complexity and the rate of change of the communications that are going on right now. Which then says that something of a the way I've always described this is rhythm becomes tone. Does that make sense what I'm saying there?
Not immediately.
So this is a good metaphor. So let me just kind of give it so we can it drops. Just think about the notion of a rhythm, just a beat, do, and then accelerate that rhythm. And what you'll notice is that for some significant period of time, it accelerates quantitatively. It increases in BPM. But phenomenologically, at a certain point, it transitions from being a sound that is a flat beat going faster to have this shift into the qualitative of becoming a tone. You hear it now as a qualitatively novel phenomenon. It has a tone to it, which the previous didn't, and which can now itself render into a whole repeat. You can now have that same tone. Let's just go with C, just middle C, can now actually begin to have a rhythm. You're bundling, notice what's happening there. You're bundling what is in fact ultimately a quantity can be defined as a quantitative phenomenon, whatever the frequency of C happens to be, musicians, sorry about that, in as the object of a new rhythm. And that new notion of moving from the quantity to the qualitative, this move that goes like this, right? It's no longer proceeding this way, but it actually goes in a new dimension. Rhythm becomes tone. So the same thing here. As the pace of the challenge, how do I say the rate of the challenge of communication across the kinds of boundaries that exist in worldview and ideological boundaries, those kinds of boundaries, passes a certain threshold, what we discover is that we're actually just in a cacophony. We cannot keep up, and it becomes increasingly noisy and increasingly frantic. And this has sort of behaviorally two possible directions. One is straight violence, increasingly random violence, by the way, towards chaos, or an ejection into a developmental liminal space in the emergence of a new quality of consciousness that operates in a different set of under a different set of rules. Right? It literally will be a different quality of the way that consciousness operates, which, by the way, by its very nature, is something that we can't currently, from the quality of consciousness that we have, identify with or predict particularly well, although we can perhaps describe some of its likely parameters.
Just a little side note that you use the expression global village. I've learned recently where that term comes from and what it meant originally. So Marshall McLuhan is the one who coined the phrase. But it's interesting when we tend to use it, we think of the whole, we've brought the whole world close in a way, so that we are confronted with cultures that may have never, entered our horizon in the past. Now everything, we've become familiar with radically different cultures, but it's interesting. He meant a bit more than that with the term. He wanted to combine global with village, and what he meant by village is the experience of living in a small town where you can't do anything without everyone knowing that you've done it. So there's a sense in which you begin a relationship, and by the end of the day, that's been communicated across town. So that's what he means by village. And then global is that this has become universal. So the idea in Marshall McLuhan's ideas is in his use of the phrase is that not only do we encounter the world, but we're also exposed to the world and to strangers in an immediate way that is really unprecedented in history. I think that was just a brilliant insight. I mean, just he didn't the internet didn't exist when he predicted the internet existed. It's just the level of the prophetic insight there is extraordinary to me.
But as long as we're invoking Brother McLuhan, we should point out that one, he was a Catholic, and utterly, I actually have a copy. His son put a copy of the prayer that he had on his desk that he would say every time he'd sit down at the desk. I have that on my desktop of my computer.
That's beautiful. Wow.
And then the second is one of the aspects of his theory. I can't remember what it's called. It's a sort of a four quadrant theory of what happens when you move from one media regime to a different media regime is the category of recall. So when you move, some portion of the past of the recent past becomes obsolete, but another portion of the deeper past is actually recalled. And the phrase is the digital recalls the medieval. So he posits, and we can hypothesize that he probably knows what he's talking about, that a big piece of what we should be, a way we should be trying to navigate the transition we're going through is to both reconnect with and remember, but also to reawaken the medieval.
Well, that brings up a really, I think, crucially important point. So, in this description of rhythm becoming tone, the emergence sort of a radically new, it's a recombination, but in a way that suddenly takes on its own absoluteness, you might say, its own sort of set of criteria and rules and so forth. That just listening to that as a layman, one could get really anxious, that this is something, it's like being cast out into a completely unknown world. We have no idea what's going to happen. But the reference that you just made to McLuhan is interesting there. The digital recalls the medieval. That there's something about it, and it's implicit in the notion of continuity that you mentioned, that it won't be it won't, for all of the radical novelty, we can anticipate at the same time a recovery of traditional ideas, a certain lost tradition, a way of thinking that has been with us, but we haven't been conscious of, you might say. And in that sense,
Oh, nice.
it's not just that we're being thrown, to use Heidegger's term, just this kind of violent being thrown into something new, but there's a sense of also the at least the possibility of coming back home, recovering something very deeply familiar to us.
Which just flashed into my mind in the category of traditions. I'll be interested. So I have received this from the Ortho Bros. I do not know if the Catholics think about it in the same way, but the notion that time, and in particular liturgical time, is a how do you say, ultimately grounded in the eternal.
That's right.
So that a particular moment, like Easter, happens on Easter, not because we put it there arbitrarily, but because that's actually of the, say, the eternal calendar, and that tone echoes through eternity into our lives. And by entering into a liturgical relationship with it in its, in fact, actual proper timing, we can most fully harmonize with the possibility of that moment. And I use moment here in sort of the Bergsonian sense.
No, that's great. I the Plato's just fantastic definition of time. I think it's the best ever, actually. Time is a moving image of eternity. A moving image of eternity. I mean, that's just a, that's such a fantastic idea. But that's exactly what liturgy is meant to be. And this is also a sense of orientation. So you know, the radical novelty that we're sort of on the brink of, if in fact this suggestion, this sort of liminal moment, to get orientation, I think it's helpful to see that we can orient ourselves through tradition and history and liturgies, so that these are ways of I guess navigating time without foreclosing the novelty of history and so forth. It's a way of keeping one foot, you might say. I don't like the metaphors that I'm using here. They're not quite capturing it, but I think you see what I'm trying to say. But
Totally, yeah.
holding on to kind of a point of orientation that I think is necessary.
Well,
So
let's see.
if I
Oh, what's your?
popped in here, Jordan, would you be able to hold that thought?
Yes.
Okay. You've got it. All right. Okay. So you said, DC, you said that we're on the brink of a radical novelty. And earlier you had asked the question, how is the world ripe for this thing that's happening right now, and what's happening in the world of science? And I took a clip this morning of a video that I was watching. Michael Levin has this academic channel where he talks with people of different fields of knowledge because he's always trying to expand his arena. And I would like to play a little bit of this clip for you because they're talking about this issue of novelty and where does novelty come from? They're starting to think about this stuff in the science world. So I thought this would be fun to do. Let's see, I gotta share a screen. I hope this is the right screen. So we're gonna go to
Kristen as well, man.
yes, it's Friston and Chris Fields and Michael Levin. It's very, very, and I'll put a link to it in the issue down below. We're going to go to 3330 on here. This is Tim Jackson, and Tim Jackson is evolutionary biology. That's his whole shtick, and I'm going to play a couple of minutes here.
Does it come from? Where do things come from? And I've been thinking about this a lot because I get asked this all the time, like when I talk about bioelectric patterns, well, where do they come from? And to me, what's very interesting is kind of the philosophical status of that question, because it seems to me that no, it's one of those questions that no answer to that question is ever satisfying. That is, no matter what you say to that question, it never feels like you've answered the question. It's a people say, well, yeah, okay, but well, where does that come from? And of course, that, any 5-year-old will sort of take it in an infinite direction. And so, to me, it's what I spend a lot of time thinking about is what is a constructive answer to that question that at least. Yeah, okay, we can always sort of go further at some point, but when have you really said something as opposed to saying nothing, knowing that you're never going to say everything? And it often in my case, you end up with, okay, so there's some genetics that set the parameters of the hardware. So let's say the ion channel properties and things like that. And then there's some environmental things that are going on. And then there's, you know, and so selection. But then also there are these sort of laws of mathematics, laws of computation that are neither of the previous things. You don't have to evolve them, and yet, you know, they're not contingent features of the environment. They're just sort of there, but they have massive implications for what patterns you do or do not get. And so you sort of name these three and you say, okay, well, it's, you know, kind of a function of those three. And that seems to be, no one finds that satisfying for some reason. And so that's what I spend a lot of time thinking about, is like, what kind of, functionally, scientifically, that actually works quite well, because knowing those things, you can then do all kinds of experiments and you can find new things. And, you know, I think a lot of the things we build are actually exploring this Platonic space outside of directed evolution. And whatever the genetic hardware is doing, like what other attractors are there in the space that we get into xenobots and anthropots and these things that have never been here on Earth before. And yet they have specific behaviors and specific forms and so on. But that's just, you know, philosophically, that's what's interesting to me, is like, can we do some good work around helping people decide what kinds of answers are useful answers? What are they really looking for when they ask that, given that they're not going to be satisfied with the questions that do lead science forward? So what else are they looking for, right? That's one thing that I have.
And then I'm going to go forward just a little bit to where Tim Jackson asked this question, which basically his question is, where does novelty come from?
And also, Mike, if possible, say something, but this notion of exaptation in biology, in evolutionary biology, there's much to say about that. But in a way, it's a kind of a principle of multiple realizability as well. It's to say that, you know, what's irrelevant from a given reference frame can become relevant in a certain sense to a slightly different reference frame. So it's sort of like, how does noise get converted into signal? And so I think, yeah, how does the irrelevant become relevant in this sense? And I think you have addressed that to a degree. But I'd love, you know, Chris, perhaps to jump in on that.
Well, I think that I would add one thing to Carl's basic story about coarse grating and the renormalization. And that is that one of the things that we are renormalizing here is what we call the system and what we consider the system of interest. And what we consider to be the system whose generative model we're describing. And all systems that we know anything about as active inference agents, one of the kinds of action that they're capable of is to organize some of the degrees of freedom of their environment into a little package that they don't control but associate closely with. So, I mean, you see this starting with quarks, right? you see it in protons that are going to go out and find some degrees of freedom of the environment, what we would call an electron or a neutron or something like that, and grab that degree of freedom and exert some sort of control over it. And that's one of the basic things that active inference agents do. And what you get out of that is a system at a larger scale with a different generative model. So a deuterium nucleus looks very different from a proton, and a hydrogen atom looks very different from a proton. And if you're a proton, you can fork and do one or the other, or you can do both.
So I won't go any farther, but that just gives you a flavor of what they're discussing and how at least in the Michael Levin constellation of thinkers, they're beginning to get all the way down to the quark level and think about how all of this stuff actually has agency of some sort.
Yeah. You know, there's a level below. Well, I'm sorry. Am I cutting you off? Were you going to say something? Yeah. There's a level even below the quark level, which is metaphysics. Whenever I hear these kinds of discussions, I think about how exciting it would be for someone in that has that extraordinary sophistication of knowledge of these scientific realities, but would also have a kind of equal sophistication in metaphysics, scholastic metaphysics. I think that would be an extraordinary wedding here. What do I have in mind in particular? The relationship between, this is a bit later than Aquinas, but sort of in modal thought, possibility and actuality. In Aquinas' thought, you know, the distinction between essence and existence, which is one of the most basic distinctions in Thomistic metaphysics. But I think it would really cast an interesting light on this, that there's a causal principle. Wolfgang Smith has adopted something of this in his notion of vertical causality. But there's a causal principle that does operate in a vertical sense. It's not simply one of the pieces in a configuration, even understood at levels of complexity with content, various increasingly comprehensive contexts and so forth, but actually transcends all contexts as a causal principle of a radically different order. And that's the principle of esse, the act of being, to be, that makes all actualities actual. And therefore, you know, any possibility insofar as it's real at all is actualized by the act of being. And what's interesting about that is it picks up, I think, on what it might mean to talk about genuine novelty. I mean, one of the implications of Aquinas' principle is that everything, you know, in every moment, to be is already a kind of an achievement, and in every moment there's a novelty. So it's not as if the things around us are no longer new and we have to look for novelty in a kind of linear sense as some interruption of what is now in the next moment, but that the very existence of things is a kind of an ongoing novelty, because we're referring the reality of things to this act of being which transcends all of what is to make it to be. Now, you know, this is a very sophisticated thought that you can't really capture in just a few sentences, but just to put it out on the board there, what this allows us to see is that novelty is not strange. I mean, in a way, it's Heidegger says something like this, you know, the extraordinary is the most ordinary thing possible, that the very existence of the world is constantly in a way held into being. And that means that if you see that, if you understand, and he didn't obviously articulate any of this with this, these sort of contemporary questions in mind, but it bears on the contemporary questions. If you see this, you realize that a kind of resources for novelty that can be unfolded in all of these really magnificent ways in the existence of a quark, in the kind of the forking that he was talking about of the proton that can be realized in one way or another way. In fact, what realizes it is something that transcends the possibilities. I feel like I'm getting very abstract here. In another context, I'd want to try to lay this out in a little more direct way. But let me just maybe end with a very simple statement that there are metaphysical principles that can be brought into the discussion that I think would be really fruitful in these scientific discussions. and one has the sense that, you know, these things are actually coming about. There seems to be a kind of growing appetite for this level of thought.
Yeah, so that's the bridge. First, go as abstract as you want for as far as I'm concerned. I have no problem with that. And you know, sometimes that's the music you got to play. What's his name? Sometimes you're at a, oh golly, what's his name? A Moon Unit Zappa. Sometimes you're at a Frank Zappa concert. And if that's where you're, you better just learn how to listen. So as a bridge, let's talk about, all right. So as the, it's funny, I'm going to be leaping back and forth because obviously you've introduced a potent sense of the meaning of the word novelty, which I definitely have not metabolized, but I could, we call it, took a bite of. So, oh, that's pate de foie gras right there. That's not a, not a cracker. But I'll use sort of the more conventional sense. So as we accelerate through an actual experience of, let's call it, first order or banal novelty, shit we haven't figured out how to deal with yet. Let's put it that way, right? Mm-hmm. Things that are, that our scripts cannot process effectively. And so we have to operate in a way of actually being in relationship with them in a fashion which ultimately overwhelms not just our scripts, but increasing our developmental capacity, right? Our actual learning is just white noised. And this can happen in many different ways. So just kind of add a few more pieces to the stack of the question that you asked a while back. One, we of course have the acceleration of technology. So the increasing addition of new actual capacities in the world of things to happen or ways for them to happen that are outside of the boundaries of what we have in our experience. And then a specific subcase of that, which is of course this category of AI, which strips down a lot of the elements of identity that we had cultivated in the period of the liberal or the Enlightenment arc. And so to the degree to which we've identified human or ourselves as being, oh, sorry, the rational animal as mm-hmm. being something that AI can do, then we're finding ourselves highly demoralized by the fact that it turns out that AI, in fact, can do it and will rapidly be doing it and much better than us. And so we either find ourselves having an identity of strictly subordinate to something that is mechanical or searching for a deeper root of identity, which the mentioning of God's gift or the continuity of relationship with the larger whole, I would propose, is, of course, the answer to that. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So as we find ourselves increasingly struggling with the rate of novelty that we're endeavoring to be in relationship, and by the way, increasingly ineffectively, we find ourselves that this has this sort of breaking effect, a shattering effect, and then a movement of really high quality scientists like the gentleman that we just spoke with mm-hmm. having to deal with metaphysics. Mm-hmm. Being forced, in some cases, kicking and screaming because the we call it the slander and booby trapping of metaphysics that was done very effectively over the last 500 years requires people to be willing to brave that traverse to be able to enter back into it. But it's a necessity, right? We've got to get back into this. Is this sort of the bridging from the horizon of science, philosophy, and ultimately theology. You have to exit the science, the place you're in science, because you can't answer the questions you're trying to answer anymore. The domain of inquiry is actually a different domain. So you have to enter into the philosophical. And as it turns out, when you're sitting in the strictly philosophical, you actually have to exit that into the theological, because that's where we are.
That's beautifully said. Thank you. That was great. I think one of the things that is helpful, and this is one of the ways I like to think of metaphysics as bridging between science and theology, and precisely this sort of sense, if you run into a certain problem within science, and then say, okay, we can't answer this within science, we then leap to a theological register. This is what often happens. And so you get the God of the gaps, and God gets sort of called in to explain how to connect A and B that we haven't seen yet. And obviously the more intelligent and often more cynical among the scientists just say, well, you know, this is we haven't yet figured out how to that connect A and B, there's always something premature in calling God in. What I think metaphysics brings in is that it you see that there's a kind of a logical necessity, and not just it's not just a sort of deus ex machina, quite literally, that's brought in, but there's a logical necessity for a kind of transcending of science that comes, that precedes any question yet of faith. And to make that concrete, kind of concrete, concrete in an abstract way, I guess. But you know, this point that you were talking about, metaphysics being booby trapped, that's such a lovely image. That's exactly right. But you know, let's set that aside and just think about what is it that we are doing when we appeal to a metaphysical register. What we're saying is that we have tended to think that we're going to get closer to the ultimate cause of things if we find the tiniest particles. So you know, it's no longer molecules, it's atoms. It's no longer atoms, it's you know, it's electrons and protons. It's now it's quarks, and we're constantly moving down to the smallest particles. And our idea is, if we can get to the most basic principles here, and then rethink the configuration of principles in relation to these, we'll get a kind of ultimate explanation. But the metaphysical move is really something different. It's not just within this order. The most basic principles within this order, it's saying, what is it that accounts for the existence of this order? Is you know, why is there even a quark? So that the do you see? It's a causal principle that's not an it's a causal principle of anything in the world, and it's not itself something in the world.
Right. Yeah. And you know, Levin did the interesting act of invoking it rapidly when he called mm-hmm. it the platonic world.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about here is the relationship between the transcendent yeah. and the, or the, that which governs the possible right. and the actual.
Yeah.
And so we can do the symmetry process thing of looking at the parts and noticing the parts are made up of parts and kind of working our way down. But there's also the continuity process thing of saying, well, what in fact is the nature
yeah.
of the,
well, and I want to try to ask, you know, that the very existence that there is a world at all is not, I mean, in a way, it's not, it's the most radically transcendent possible
mm-hmm.
perspective. And it's not just the wholeness of the world. It's that there is a world at all. So, you see, In a way, it's more radical than even Plato. I think that this does require a certain, Plato was certainly gesturing towards it, but it requires a sense of a creator, ex nihilo, a creator in the most complete sense possible.
Right. Well, we can also include that it also, as far as I can tell, requires that we move from a how would you call it, an objective relationship to a personal relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Both. Right. Right. Yeah. Well, so I think that's then a second move. I mean, once one recognizes that there has to be a radically transcendent cause that isn't one of the things caused. So, you know, a principle.
Well, can I ask you both a question about this? Because there are people in this corner.
Yeah.
That haven't accepted the idea of a personal,
yeah,
a personal God,
yeah,
but that, and actually don't even, I think, accept the fact of God as being the transcendent source of all things, but they do talk about the transcendent,
yeah,
and I would say even Michael Levin is gesturing towards this when he talks about, you know, Plato's world of ideas and mathematics and. That there's stuff that's stored out there. I mean, he even talks about, I don't know how much of his work you've seen, David. About form and how, as animals are forming from the zygote, that they're exploring a world of, he calls it morphogenesis, to find their way through, because there's not enough information in the DNA to bring about the final form. But do you get inside these people's heads and understand how there can be some idea of the transcendent? How, what do they think that there, that that has some, if it has no causal force, what do they mean by transcendent? What, I love John Vervaeke. He's a wonderful, wonderful mind, and he certainly taught us many wonderful things. But what does he mean when he talks about the transcendent, if that transcendent is not God? Well, what else is there?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy. I do want to make a distinction between a radical cause, first cause. So, and here's where I would make a distinction between metaphysics and theology. A sense of a radically first cause. And, you know, I can't stress those words anymore, that that first in the absolute sense, that that there has to be, you know, even when we talk about the transcendent or the forms or higher powers, that there is higher powers in the first place, that there are forms is itself has to be a principle that transcends forms. I mean, in a certain sense, it seems to me, and this actually is logically necessary. I think that you if you follow thinking faithfully, you do have to confront that there has to be a cause of all other causes. In a way, it's a supra. It's supra transcendent. Absolutely first. Okay, now that doesn't, I think that there's a difference though between, and this is where kind of connects with an earlier part, to recognize that first cause as God in a personal sense, I think requires a gift from God that invites us into personal relationship that you don't reason your way to. And I think that that is really a distinctive moment. That's distinct from recognizing that there has to be a radically first cause of all things. So I have sympathy with people that recognize something transcendent, but are hesitant about God. But because I don't think that there's the same kind of necessity there that really does enter in. And this is why, you know, if this weren't the case, there would be no such thing as love. There would be no such thing as faith and hope. That is possible only because God takes the initiative.
All right, let me make a run at it from a different angle. I think these end up being mutually supporting, highly mutually supporting. So, if you take it, well, okay, let's just begin with the notion of relationship. Broadly speaking, we can sort of say, okay, we're talking about qualities of relationship. And roughly, we can bucket it into two. You either have personal or impersonal. Mm-hmm. And the category of impersonal relationship has certain capabilities and limitations. So it is the I-thou versus I-it, right? We've got a lot of folks have talked deeply about this, but it's important to be able to say, okay, that's actually real. Now, the part of the distinction that I'm going to weigh in on is the actual bandwidth limitation of the impersonal relationship. There's just a... If I have an in-person relationship with my wife, I'm relating to her as an object. Mm-hmm. I'm relating to her as something that I render only available to that which I can ultimately articulate in a semantic string. I render her computational. Computational and impersonal are effectively identical. Mm-hmm. And so I think about this in the category of that which can be rendered analytically. That can be entered in the lower register of the rational. But ultimately, in this case, endeavoring to govern or to control or to manage. That's what the impersonal is about exclusively. I decontextualize a infinite wholeness on the basis of a particular purpose. I select from myself the set of faculties that are specifically associated with that purpose. I bring those two finite elements into a particular impersonal relationship, and I endeavor to move towards the purpose, right? That's what we're talking about. But what I notice is that if I do that to something like my wife or my child, I am radically undermining the actual lived relationship. In other words, I notice that if I simply open myself up to the wholeness of my wife, all of my impersonal capacities are utterly overwhelmed, utterly transcended. Think of them as having they're a finite box. There's a certain limit of their capacity, and there's more going on than they can handle. This is a very simple version of the transcendent, right? If I just have a box and I say, okay, you're going outside of that box, I have transcended that box. I have the experience that my faculties, my capacities of being in impersonal relationship are strictly incapable of actually perceiving the wholeness with which I am manifestly in relationship. I am gobsmacked, right? I am surprised. I am utterly undermined in my ability to say, holy crap, there's something going on over there that is actually deeper than I currently can perceive. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I have one and only one recourse, which is I open up the wholeness of myself and I enter into a personal relationship. That which in me is in fact equal to that which is in her, i.e. something which is intrinsically infinite in nature, or at least very, very large in nature, I can hold off on the infinite for the moment, has at least some possibility. And it's no longer hamstrung by its overwhelm, but is able to enter into something like a dance, right? The personal. Mm-hmm. Now, DC has mentioned, we have the same problem when we enter into an actual relationship with the beingness of reality. Mm-hmm. For me, living in Black Mountain, it's when I look at a particular mountain or a particular tree, and I am utterly overwhelmed, right? Existentially destroyed by the fact that it exists at all. And my limited faculties of in-person relationship endeavor to grasp the reality that being is. And as they endeavor to do so, they are completely destroyed. And I am, in some sense, brought to my knees. I rarely actually physically collapse because I'm aware of the awkwardness of that in public. But nonetheless, at an intellectual level, that's exactly what happens. And then I am popped into this new register. Like my wife, I now must enter. I must surrender to the fact that the only way of being able to have a real and in some sense plausible relationship with this bare fact of the beingness of isness in front of me, that which I am, right, the I am-ness of being, is to enter into this register of the personal, to enter the register of the wholeness of myself, endeavoring to be in relationship with the wholeness of the reality in which with which I am encountering. All right, so that's, I think, a simple way of saying it.
Yeah. Three things.
You perfectly articulated the process of making a painting. Mm. It's exactly the same process because you have this idea that you're trying to bring into material reality. And so you have all your tools and your materials and your substrate, and they're all useful. There's a lot of utility to it, very pragmatic process. But in trying to bring that idea into material reality, you have to have a relationship with the idea and in some sense with the source of the idea that is continually being reiterated as you work. And as you look at the result of what you're getting, is it beginning to match up to that idea or not match up to the idea? And when you recognize the magnitude of the distance between the idea in your head and what you're capable of putting on the paper or on the canvas, there's this sense of, if you don't surrender yourself to the idea completely and allow that idea to flow through you, mm-hmm. and produce things that you never could have produced with your own rational intellect on that piece of paper, then you're not going to see the realization of the beauty that is in the original idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a magnificent explanation of it. And, you know, David, you were talking about the metaphysics that is underneath the quarks. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I've had this idea that there is something even under the metaphysics somehow. Or maybe it is part of, I don't understand the concept of metaphysics all that well and how metaphysics differs from theology. Maybe you can explain that later. Yeah. But for me, learning the principles of art, the principles of design, opened a whole new world to me to understand that the principles of design that have been observed are not man-made. They're just observations of the millennia of what what produces beauty, or what, how do we perceive beauty through what we look at? And those principles have to do with how these, how they all intersect. So how the rhythm and proportion and balance and value and repetition, the way that you do shape and line, all of these things intersect. You could take all of those and you could look at every quark in the universe and you could identify where that quark lives and what its relationships are with all the other quarks. And you could say, there's a perfect balance and proportion and rhythm and sense of repetition and all of these different principles. You could identify all these quarks in the universe. One of the things Stephen Wolfram's researchers told him is that they go down below the quark level, down to what they call the eames. And he says if every eam does not have a unique user ID, the universe would collapse, which means that there has to be something about the location and participation of every eam with every other eam in the way that they interact. And to me, that's the principles that produce beauty. I haven't learned how to describe that in a way that the way it's in my head, but anyway, that's the base concept.
Well, if I could, there's so much that both of you now have put out there. Just a couple comments. One is, notice it's kind of interesting that the I, thou, I, it relation, we tend to think of the I, thou in these sort of terms, enchanted terms that you were both kind of laying out. And then the I, it would be a more kind of instrumental, rationalized relationship. But it's interesting that Jordan used, a tree as an example, or Karen, you were talking about quarks. I mean, those are presumably its, but it's interesting. You notice that they're not mirror objects. There's nothing in the world that's a mirror object when you think of it in terms of its being, as we've been describing. So there's something of the I thou that enters into even these relationships. Okay, that's one point. The second one, it's kind of interesting there's something that is transformative. So Jordan, you talk about looking at your wife and you're overwhelmed by this reality here that is greater than and causes you to, in a way, transcend your prior conceptions and the box you may, your consciousness may sort of be in, because you recognize, you come to see that there's something even greater, a mystery on the other side. What's interesting too is that there's a kind of recasting of even your sense of self. So what's amazing is not just that you become aware of the other, but that you actually you experience yourself in a new way as the other of the other. You think of yourself as being addressed by her. And this, I think, bears in some way on the idea that a painter has with a painting. There's this realm that opens up that you might say is kind of between the subject and the object. It's not like I've got I'm a poor painter, but I used to do a bit of painting in the old days. I'm trying to get back into it, actually. But it's never been my experience, the way some people describe it, that you have like this idea in your head, you know exactly what you're going to paint, and then you try to put it on the paper. There's this constant, and you use the word reiteration, this kind of constant sort of recapitulation. You realize that the idea that you have is not in your head as opposed to there. It's sort of beyond both of you. There's a kind of, you're learning about it even as you are trying to impose it. You discover it precisely in the process of creating it. And that there's a kind of reciprocity that goes on there. Which is really beautiful. Anyway, then the third point, I'll try to make this very brief. This is what I mean by novelty. When you're looking at the tree and you just amazed at the isness of this tree, the is that that it is at all. Okay, I mean, is it new or is it not new? You know, I mean, in a certain sense, it's the same tree, but you're seeing it as in a certain sense arriving into reality in just this moment. And that's what I mean by kind of a radical kind of novelty that would be different from linear novelty, as in it's going to change, what I see will change in the next minute. No, the very being of it is new and old at the same time. And that's what I mean by a kind of a metaphysical reference point in the thatness of the world, bringing that into our thinking about it, that kind of novelty. And then you know, linear novelty is a sort of cashing out of it, but it's not the most fundamental expression of what novelty means.
Totally, yes. Yeah. So check this out. This is what the reference points that lit up for me there. So you've got Kars, Finite Infinite Games, and the notion of the distinction between art as artifact and art as the continuity of contact with the transcendent. Right. So the artist, the process of being in relationship with the transcendent, which enables the expression of that which wants to transcend, to express itself through you, is art, right? In this case, also novelty. And then the artifact is not art. It is the end process, which in some sense carries two elements. It carries a bit of the imprimatur, the ambiance of art, and it's very good, easy to sell. Right. So the shifting into the category of novelty that we have become inured to, I just realized, is merely the consequence of the fact that we need to be able to commoditize novelty.
Yeah.
We've needed to actually take the hit of novelty, which is in fact a biologically evolved thing, and turn it into a frisson that can be packaged and reproduced and reproduced and reproduced as a commodity. But what you're pointing to is that the actual source and origin of that thing is an actual direct connection to the eternal, to that which gives access to meaning, that which gives source, that which is creativity itself in essence. And so then I was perceiving that experience of the return to Easter, right? The return to that which is the same, but is in fact actually fundamentally grounding in the infinite, and therefore is not the same, but is eternal. And these are qualitatively distinct ways of thinking about it. And so instead of the cheapened version of eternity that we perceive as novelty, we're pointing back towards an actual lived experience of eternity that is available in the things that appear to be relatively the same.
Right. Right. So in that sense, it's a transcending of time rather than transcending a particular moment in time.
Yeah.
A transcending of time simply. And that's and you know, that's why, you know, ever ancient, ever new, this notion of what beauty is in St. Augustine, in which I think is connected to real ritual, religious ritual. Easter yeah. is such an extraordinary, I mean, because, you know, in the whole triduum of passion, death, and resurrection of Christ, the understanding is that you're actually you're not just remembering it, acting it out, but that event is an eternal event. St. Paul talks about the pleroma,
great word.
Yeah, the fullness of time. It's not just an important moment. It's the fullness of time. And when we celebrate the ritual, we're actually stepping out of, in a way, our time and entering into that time. Kairos as opposed to Chronos or something. That I think that's really crucial. And it's, you know, it's paradigmatic in religion, but I think that there's something analogous in art. Schopenhauer has some beautiful reflections on how art is a, you know, the experience of a beautiful art object also invites us in some analogous sense to step outside of time.
A reunification of art and religion when we orient beauty first in our relationship with the sacred, right? So the disordering of moving truth first, which is also another characteristic of the last half or millennium or such, has the consequence of separating things like art and religion, and by the way, art and science. But once you reorder things properly and you put beauty first, then you notice that the act of art and the act of religion are in fact identical. They're both.
I would also say the act of science.
Yeah.
The actual act of science.
The thing that all great scientists have pointed to, which is right, the deepest theory is the most beautiful theory, right? So you come there, and then the work of science is great. It's very important, right? It is actually the artifacting of science into things that can then be distributed more broadly, right? So we're maintaining the continuity of contact. It's plugged in, science plugged into reality, as opposed to science separated from reality and merely increasingly noisily making up its own nonsense, by the way. We should point that out.
Well, the paradigm or frame that Dorothy Sayers uses in her book, The Mind of the Maker, you just went from here to here to here. Mm-hmm. You started at the bottom and you went up. So in her paradigm, it would be the idea, the energy, and the power. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is then translated through energy into material artifact. And then the power is the power that the artifact now has in the culture, in the environment. Mm-hmm. So she would say that's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And so the energy, Christ is the outworking of the Father into the world. And then the Holy Spirit translates, communicates this to the world at large. And so you just identified science in exactly that frame, which is the way I've been thinking about it for quite some time. If science were submitted to the larger truth.
Right.
But then that brings up the question of really what is truth and how can we communicate what truth is to the world of science? Because scientists tend to think that they have a very different concept of truth than truth as it lives in theology and metaphysics.
Well, and let's bring art back in here too. I think that point you made, that's a really helpful one, because we tend to think of art conventionally as just about stuff that's fun to look at, you know, delightful to look at, or you know, pretty or edgy or something. But the idea that in art there's a kind of a presence of reality that comes to expression that's not altogether different from the kind of reality that science is studying and the kind of reality that theology and metaphysics is after, that also gives a substance to our sense of what art is about. And if we see that connection, I mean, all these then become kind of reciprocally fructifying, we come to see that truth is not just, you know, correctness of data, but is the manifest, you know, has this, for something to be true, it's a manifestation of its reality. That changes the way we would approach science. It changes the way we would approach art. It changes the way we would approach philosophy and religion. It's just your sense of truth.
I'm going to throw something out there. I'm not sure if it's true. What I was just seeing visually, I suppose, or in some kind of simulation of the visual, was the hypostatic union of the logos is what we mean by the word truth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just the same way that we find ourselves gobsmacked by the beingness it is, we should also be gobsmacked by the fact that words and things can in fact correspond at all.
Yeah.
Right? That both distinct beings can somehow have something that is the sameness or connection, actual conjugation or communion, that communion is possible at all. And this is the work of the logos. So the work of science is to proceed by means of the logos to enable the continuity of contact between the subjective and the objective.
Yeah. Didn't Einstein say something about the fact that the world is intelligible at all is a miracle?
It is in fact radical.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
In fact, Christ. So yes, utterly. And again, exactly. So Einstein looks at that, perceives it, and he has that experience of miracle, meaning shit. I can't, that's That strictly transcendent. Nothing I can do about that. It's beyond me.
It's beyond me, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and real.
And it's real, and it resonates with our deepest needs as well. It's an extraordinary thing.
Oh, Einstein.
Yeah. So, Karen, I'm going to have to.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a great place to end, unless you have something.
That was a pretty awesome way to end. I felt like we had a nice meeting of the minds. It always takes time to get there, but yeah.
And just a quick reminder for those who might still be with us, there's going to be a conference in Olympia, Washington, September 12th through the 15th, called Encountering Face-to-Face. I'm speaking. I'm one of the speakers. Michael Martin is a speaker. Dr. Chris Green, Rafe Kelly of Evolve Move Play, and Paul Vanderclay, and probably one other that I'm just not remembering right now. But it's going to be a great opportunity to get together and talk about these things, and also to experience the estuary protocol. So I'll put everything in the notes below. This has been absolutely great. I'm looking forward to the conversation between Jordan and Michael Levin, because I've been trying to introduce Michael Levin to more of this world. So
yeah,
it's going to be awesome. And we'll talk to you guys again soon, I hope.
Yeah. Thank you for your hospitality here in the little corner, as you call it.
Been absolutely delightful listening to you too. So have a great day.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
Bye. Good to meet you, Jordan.
Super good to meet you.
Yeah, good luck with everything.